It's the best time of the year. I don't know if there'll be snow, but have a cup of cheer. Have a holly jolly Christmas.
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Olin, joined by the boss, John Roerink, a little later. John, you're going to be speaking with the governor of the state of Michigan, Rick Snyder, for our year-end review, and appreciate him being available for that. Well, let's start then with a year-end review. This is going to be our last regular podcast. The next two podcasts, we're going to do our year-end awards, but let's talk about the year 2017. I'm going to label it the year of the big conservative dream. And let me tell you where I'm going with this.
You mean the year that wasn't?
I feel like we have hit the ceiling on what is accomplishable when you have an all-Republican legislature and a Republican governor, a Republican everything in this state. We found out what you can do and what you can't do. And what you can't do is no-fault insurance. You can't do an income tax cut. You can't do full-throttle OPEB reform. But you can still fiddle around with MIPSRs, the teacher retirement system, to an extent.
It's true. I mean, we've talked about it before. If you think about the composition of what we've got here, you've got a Republican governor, but he's not nearly as conservative as the majorities that we have in the state House and the state Senate. So he's not going to go necessarily where the speaker, where Tom Leonard might want to go, or Arlen Meekhoff might want to go. I think he's got limits. I mean, he's got limits when it comes to gun changes. He's got limits issues he wants to focus on, and then that's what we've done.
And it's just not the governor, too. I mean, let's take a look at the state House. An income tax cut didn't pass through the House. No-fault insurance reform didn't pass through the House. So it's just not him. And then let's talk about changes to municipal retirement benefits. That wouldn't have cleared either chamber. So it's just not the governor. We see how far an ideology will go. And I think we've kind of hit the limits as how far you can go. Kind of makes you wonder what's in store for next year then. I mean, if we can't do no fault and we can't do auto insurance reform or post-retirement benefits reform, we're not interested in doing a tax cut. Kind of makes you wonder, with this crew, what do we have to look forward to in 2018?
I think it's going to be a lot of looking at what the voters are going to be deciding at the end of 2018. And then how does the legislature and how are the conservative Republican caucuses going to respond to what the voters give them?
Because you take a look at maybe some issues that they could tackle. Let's say an A through F grading scale, for instance. That seems to be a heavy lift. We're still trying to figure out what we're doing with the emergency manager. That looks like that's going to be a punt into 2019, doesn't it? We're also trying to figure out what we're doing as far as like a teacher, a school grading system as it relates to do we start closing down schools if they don't meet a certain threshold. That's what's in the law because that's what we were supposed to do to meet these federal guidelines, but that isn't being followed. We're not shutting down poor performing schools. Infrastructure, they feel like they've got that already taken care of. What are they going to do, John?
I don't know. We're going to have to wait around and find out, aren't we?
I guess one thing that we do know that they're going to be doing is that we've got the ballot petition languages in for repealing prevailing wage. But there again, that could be an issue for the ballot box. We're going to have to see if they have the votes in the Republican House to get that through. They didn't have it under Kevin Cotter. Will they under Tom Leonard?
It's a good question. It's certainly going to be one of the big issues that is going to be a battleground for next year.
It would seem to me that they feel like they have the votes, because when you see the other side putting together their own ballot petition drive, it would seem to me that they think that this is not going to happen, or this is going to happen, that the House has the votes, and that they might as well just kind of gear up for the next step, unless that they feel like, well, this is going to be a backdrop. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think the House has probably got a better shot at it than the income tax. I think the income tax cut raised a lot of questions that there weren't really good answers for. I don't think that this is going to be viewed in the same light. I think there's going to be more members of the Republican caucus that are going to be ready to jump on this.
I would think so. Okay. So 2018, we're going to have two congressional seats open, John, that have not been open. Well, one in my lifetime, and then another not since I was in maybe the fourth or third grade. And I don't think I'm still that young. This is the 9th and the 13th congressional district. Let's start with the 9th congressional district, where we've got Andy Levin and Steve Beto already jumped into the race. There's room for more. Will there be more?
That's a great question. Right now, I think when you look at it, it's going to be a fascinating race because I think Beto has sort of the map advantage. I think Levin clearly has the name advantage. And it's going to be real curious to see if Steve Beto can kind of out-hustle that Levin legacy.
And I think a big question, too, is going to be who else gets into this race. Because if you get Andy Meisner, the Oakland County Treasurer, in, then maybe you get more people in on the Macomb County side. Let's say you get a Sarah Roberts in on Macomb. Maybe there's some more Macomb people get in. Does that get Robert Wittenberg into the race, the state representative? He hasn't ruled that out. In a large field, he may try and carve out a niche with progressives, but in a small field, maybe no. Does Andy Meisner give it a go, or does he kind of save it for the Oakland County executive race? Is that maybe where his next step is? And in Macomb County, I mean, Sarah Roberts has said that there should be a female in the race, but is she the one to do it? She's been out of the country for several months on kind of her sabbatical. And if not her, then who? I mean, that's always kind of the question with these races, right? You think, well, there's room for somebody else till you try and figure out who that somebody is.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good question, too. I wonder, and I'm curious your reaction, if there are more candidates that slice and dice Oakland and Macomb County, does that strengthen Andy Levin's position?
Well, it seems like it would strengthen Andy's if Macomb County is diced up. But if Oakland County's diced up, then it would help Steve Beto. Mm-hmm. So I think they're trying to prevent other people from getting in their respective counties, mm-hmm. and just make it a mano-a-mano.
Yep, absolutely.
And, you know, that 9th congressional district, there's always kind of been that Macomb County fission and the Levin fission. I remember going to these convention meetings before, and they've been very, they can be very tense at times between these two factions of the 9th. So this being able to be played out in front of the voters would be great if it's a one-on-one. We'll see if we get there. One race that will not be a one-on-one is going to be the 13th congressional district. That is going to be a soup.
That's going to be a soup, and what's fascinating about this one is the fact that we could have two Conyers in this race trying to live off that legacy name thing that that Andy Levin is going to have all by himself in the 9th.
And in the case of Ian Conyers or John Conyers III, and Ian's been elected to the state Senate. He was able to beat Fred Durhall for that position, but it's not as if he's been around for a super long time. He spent a significant time in D.C. before coming back, and same thing with John Conyers III. He has not been around Michigan for a while. He was in New York, then he was in California. He was in California earlier this year. So it's not as if they are established entities themselves in the city of Detroit, and that may hurt them a little bit when it comes to the fundraising base.
It certainly will, and I thought it was fascinating, the poll that we ran on Friday that showed the Conyers name is still very valued in that district. They really feel like he had a high job approval rating, even the way he went out. Although the people, majority supported his decision to step down, they felt he was doing a good job. I was surprised when Ed Serpolo said that he thought if the race were in 30 days, John Conyers Jr. could win it again. So, I mean, that's amazing. So I think if you think about Ian and you think about John Conyers III, one of those two guys, I think, is going to have to get out of the race in order to take advantage of that family name. Clearly, the poll shows, the Wayne County Sheriff, Benny Napoleon, is clearly in the lead. He's got the most name identification. He's got the biggest base. So it's going to be fun.
I don't know if John Conyers III, just from looking at it, is going to have the stomach to stay in this race. I mean, when his name was thrown out by his dad, the stories that came out about him being in the Escalade and the abuse potential charge or complaint, I guess it was, in California. He's tweeted some odd things in his younger years. It makes you wonder if the voters are going to be able to look past that. He may not have the stomach. I'm just going to say, I don't know if he's going to have the stomach to be able to do this. Where I think you're going to see Ian Conyers clearly has the fire in his belly. He's ready to go. I think he's been priming for this for several years anyway. The question, I think, is who's going to be that suburban candidate? Will it be Kinesic? Will it be Wild? Will they both get in? I don't know if there's room for both of them.
I don't know. Do they cancel each other out? I mean, is the only Caucasian candidates? Does that impact the bottom line of the race?
It seems like it could. I mean, if you take a look at that being, let's say it's 40%, anywhere from between 40 to 50% is not in Detroit, does that give them an opportunity? It depends how big of a voting population comes out in the city of Detroit. I mean, and for the Democratic gubernatorial primary, remember, that's going to be going on at the same time. Who's motivating Detroit? Who's getting them out to vote? Or will it be that inner ring of suburbs that gets excited to vote? I have a hard time believing that if Wild gets in, and he was just reelected now, just a month ago. If Wild gets in, I have a hard time seeing Kinesic get in. I think Kinesic's trying to work Wild right now to try and keep him from getting in, because if Wild's a no, Kinesic's a yes. That's my prediction.
I think you're probably right about that, and it's going to all come down to what is going to be driving out voter turnout in August. I mean, will we have a big battle at the top of the ticket? Will that push more people out? Will there be enough excitement on this local level, since this seat hasn't been open since before I was born, to really turn them out?
And then you take a look at other potential candidates. We haven't even talked about the one who was on the top in this poll, Benny Napoleon. If he were to get in, I think Gretchen Whitmer would have liked to have him being her running mate on the top of the Democratic ticket. But hey, if you got a shot at Congress, that's a possibility too. He's run many times before, would be able to raise a lot of resources. So clearly he's got name ID and he could raise some money. Would he want it? I mean, that's another question, right? Would you want the job of being in Congress? And
that's shown that he wants to. I mean, would you rather be lieutenant governor, or would you rather be a member of Congress? And then again, the lieutenant governor, that's a shot. You know, I mean, if he wins the primary, and he's got this thing wrapped up as far as Congress, but you know, being her running mate doesn't necessarily guarantee him 8 years as lieutenant governor.
Or does he want to just stay being Wayne County Sheriff? Yeah. I mean, that's not a bad gig
either.
That's
not a bad gig either, no.
So he doesn't really maybe lose anywhere. Brenda Jones is a possibility, too. I mean, she comes in with a lot of name ID. She seems to be very popular with the electorate. So a lot of different choices there. And wouldn't this be interesting if you had three people from the Democratic caucus, Kinesic, Coleman Young, and Morris Hood, all in that race? Wouldn't that just be something else?
Mm-hmm. It would be fascinating.
And then Ian Conyers to boot, too. We could have four.
Yeah,
have a quarter of that caucus running for that seat.
Isn't that amazing? I guess that's what happens when you got such a small caucus.
And you know, if Bert Johnson weren't in hot water right now, he'd probably look at it, too. He ran for that seat, too.
He probably would, yeah.
Oh, this kind of stuff is great. All right, well, John, let's go ahead and move on to your interview with the governor.
Welcome to the podcast, Governor, and Merry Christmas.
Oh, Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. It's great to be with you.
All right. Well, I want to start with an off-the-wall question that you probably haven't gotten, hopefully, yet. Do you have any good government concerns about Tesla and now this Indiana wine retailer suing the state and using the judicial process to obtain emails from legislators about legislative strategy?
I haven't spent a lot of time on either of those issues. I'm aware they're out there. I view it as they're out just going through the normal process. Again, we're a public organization. We're a government, so we should be accessible.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the agreement you reached with Enbridge. I mean, was that done outside the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board, and if so, why?
Well, we went ahead and got the agreement done. What I'd say is there was the recent resolution by the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board. I would just step back for a minute and look at that and say you had five people voting out of a 16-member board. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate those five people's perspective, but I am also interested in the other 11. Mm-hmm. In terms of the Enbridge one, though, I think we made real progress.
Okay.
That was a very difficult situation. Enbridge had not been a straight shooter in terms of information to the public or to us. That was unacceptable. It's the Great Lakes, so we have to be very strong in our measures, and I think we moved ahead in an agreement that's a strong agreement that moves us forward, but I'm very guarded about this. I'm not taking anything for granted, so we need to follow up very closely to make sure it's being followed to the letter.
How do you respond to arguments that with the support issue, there really are outside the easement now?
Well, again, I want to solve the long-term problem. So how do we address the pipeline appropriately? And not just the pipeline underneath the Great Lakes. People forget there are a lot of water crossings for the pipeline, and there's also on the bottom of the river of the St. Clair River pipeline. Mm-hmm. And so how do we comprehensively deal with the Enbridge pipeline and look at all the options?
Okay. With the general fund dedicated spending for the road package coming due, we've also got the updated homestead exemption coming up and more PPT relief on the way. How is it possible the state won't be facing a $2 billion hole that the Citizens Research Council has warned us about?
Yeah, well, again, there are things we should be looking at in terms of our general fund and school aid fund. Economically, we've been doing reasonably well. For the general fund itself, there are challenges that you can face. I wouldn't describe it as a deficit to the state as a whole. It's really, what do we have in each one of our funds and how do we manage that? We have some inequities about how the funds get allocated resources. One of the things that came up earlier part of last year was on our income tax. Income tax revenue comes in. All the revenues, all the refunds come out of the general fund, even though it's allocated between the two funds. So one of the questions you can naturally ask, should we be looking at improvements to say, to the degree the money comes in this way and gets split between the two funds, shouldn't the refunds be coming out evenly going back that direction?
So that's something you'd like to see the legislature address again?
That's something I talked about before, and that would address this problem largely.
Okay. For cities and municipalities that haven't replaced their lead pipes, what do you think an appropriate state kick-in would be to help the projects get started? 10%, 50%? Or should this be the sole responsibility of the local units of government?
That's a question that I'm sure people will be discussing. Some communities have done it, and I appreciate them being proactive. Lansing's a good case. They took a number of years to do it. I would hope most communities are already doing it in some fashion. That's something we need to follow up on. That's one of the reasons we're looking at doing some lead and copper rules. With respect to the cost split, I view that as a later discussion as we find out who has the problem, how much we're talking about, and what are the issues. But generally, that's an expense for the local community.
Okay. Do you thinking about the fall ballot proposals that might come up, if the voters approve recreational marijuana, do you have any good governance concerns or issues you're thinking about if that gets adopted?
Well, again, if that got adopted, it's really making sure there's accountability and transparency of what's going on. The amount of money being involved, the subject matter that's involved, there's a lot of potential for abuse. And so that's, I would say, we should really double and triple down on making sure we have the right control system and accountability system put in place.
Okay. Is the what we've done as far as medical marijuana a good start, or would there have to be more, you think?
I think that was a very good start. I think there is a lot of rigorous steps involved in that process. But what I'd say is we put that in process, we'll learn from it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we know all the answers because it's a new system, but as you actually put it in place, that'll tell us if there's weaknesses or strengths and how it might need to be changed appropriately to make sure it stays strong.
Okay. As an advocate of free markets, what's wrong with the idea of Tesla opening up a store in the Lansing Mall to sell their cars?
I don't have a real issue with that other than the fact it doesn't comply with Michigan law at this point in time. So it's really up to the legislature to decide they're going to change the law.
Okay. On education, over your tenure, the state's increased what it sends to the schools, yet scores seem to kind of remain a little bit stagnant. What do you attribute that to?
I think a lot of it is we have a lot of historical structures in place, and change takes time, and it takes time to see the results show up. One of the things I'm proud of is we did some great things, I think, to really help with early childhood education. We did that several years ago. That takes a few years for those kids to get those experiences and to get through the system, because, again, you're talking about third grade would be one of the first testing metrics. So we're 3 or 4 years out from that when we started a couple years ago. So hopefully we'll start seeing some of the longer-term benefits of that. The pre-3 reading we put in place, that's geared to help deal with this. That's only a year or so old. And then we're doing a lot of stuff at the high school kind of community college level. So a lot of our educational stuff was geared to get kids going into the system to have more resources and opportunity and then help kids find careers, young people find careers even better. And hopefully we'll see a continuing improvement of the entire process. One of the things we do have legislatively I'd still like to see is A to F put in place. I think there should be grades. I mean, the color system, go back to the color system that was put back in 2009-10. Does anyone even know what a color means, mm-hmm. let alone that it's still even out there?
Mm-hmm. But what do you think the prospects for that are?
Well, it's been challenging, but I think this will be a good time to do it. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it. Let's put something in place that can have better accountability, because doesn't everyone want to see better results for these kids? And I want to have our teachers and administrators have the best tools, and you can't do that if you can't measure it.
Mm-hmm. Other than that, what's your other number one priority, I guess, for 2018?
Well, my number one priority continues to be the talent question, about how we get people career connected. That's been a priority for several years. From the professional trades, there are tens of thousands of great opportunities out there, to emerging fields such as mobility, information technology, cybersecurity, industrial automation, robotics. These are all great careers that are well-paying. We need to get more people connected to those, and we need to work on having our institutions have all the programs in place to provide that training.
Okay. Thinking back now, since we're at the end of 17, what was your highlight this year legislatively? What were you proud of? What were you frustrated by that you would have liked to have seen done?
Well, a couple things on the proud of. I think if you look at the retirement reforms, both at the state and local level, we should be proud of those. That's going to be something that's going to help people have a more solid retirement and really help us be smarter and better over the next 20 to 30 years, I hope, to make up for past problems. So that's a great thing. A couple other pieces, I think some of the economic incentive stuff was very good. The Hudson's groundbreaking just took place. That's incredible to think about. And again, these are very limited, special purpose kind of incentives. They're not, you know, give the store away kind of things. So I think they were well done. And then the Career Pathways Alliance, some of the legislation going through, but the whole public-private partnership about bringing the private sector in, with the education sector, with government, with all of us working together on this talent question.
Mm-hmm. And on the bad side?
On the bad side, I wish we would have gotten more done. No Fault would have been an illustration of something that would have been nice to see.
Is that something we're going to see another run at that next year?
Well, again, I think we need to let the dust settle on that one because, again, you need some cooling off period, but that's something I would hope still can be addressed in some fashion.
All right. On that, any big holiday plans?
Big holiday plans is not to have big plans, but to have some quality time with
maybe?
Family. A little downtime.
Oh, good for you. Good for you. Well, thank you very much, and appreciate the time you spent with us today.
Yeah, happy holidays.
You too.
That wraps up another edition of the MERS Monday podcast. I'd like to issue a special thank you to Governor Rick Snyder for being our guest this week. We at MERS would like to wish our listeners and our subscribers a very happy holiday season. We'll be back with you next week. In the meantime, we'd also like to thank AT&T for sponsoring this and every MERS Monday podcast. With that, I'm John Roering, and have a great week.
But have a cup of cheer. Have a holly jolly Christmas. And when you walk down the street, say hello to friends you know and everyone you meet. Ho, ho, the mistletoe hung where you can see. Somebody waits for you. Kiss her once for me.